A survey asked a group of teens for reflections on life as they viewed it today. Here's one teen's response. The economy is shot. The family unit is in trouble. Respect for authority is a joke. For the right price, you can buy yourself a senator or a judge, or he is out buying himself a 16-year-old to use for a couple of hours. Money is worthless, and you're worthless without it. You should stop worrying about why your son needs a drink before he can face his morning classes, or why your daughter went out and got pregnant. Just help them cope with the reality of life. Before throwing us into categories, just remember that we have to run this joint in 30 years when you die off or retire or starve on your Social Security. I'll leave it up to you. Either give us a little help and understanding or put the world out of its misery and send up the missiles and hope Mother Nature has better luck with the next thing that crawls up out of the slime. That's sad, isn't it? On so many fronts. Sad, first of all, I would say that his observations about culture are pretty spot on, and that's sad. But for such a young age, someone to have that much despairing of hope, what a great tragedy. But chaos and confusion reigns today. We've seen two plus generations of this, maybe three generations even of this kind of hopelessness. We referenced in week one, Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2, speaking of how the Lord provides for His own. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. In verse 6, there will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day and refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. That's how God works for His own, as an example. And we use that as a reference point for parents. The task that parents have to create that kind of protection and provision and what we said, shade for our children. Our children need protection from the storm and the rain and the heat of the day. It might be said for those of us that are like my age in the 60s that we grew up in a little bit of shade. Our grandparents and parents had planted some trees and we grew up in the shade of those trees. But there's really not much shade left for children today. And the current generation doesn't seem to be planting any trees for the next generation. And that doesn't bode well for our society, for any society. It doesn't bode well, we might even say, for the earth itself. Our children and grandchildren then are going to be exposed to the blistering world that is left when all the shade is gone. And that's what that teenager that I just quoted is already feeling. That burning heat of a world that is just full of despair. So we have to plant trees. We have to produce shade for the next generation. That's why we're here. That's why we're doing this series. And I'm greatly encouraged that so many of you keep coming out week after week in the middle of the week. It really is for all of us. It isn't just for parents and grandparents. We're talking about our culture. We're talking about our future. We're talking about our churches and our communities. And all of those things should be of interest to all of us. In some sense, we just keep asking the same question over and over. How do we get here in this mess? And how do we get out of this mess? Well, two important texts connected together help us to focus now in this hour on parents and our responsibility and what God says to us. So how do we parent by the book? And you can turn here if you want, but it's two texts out of Deuteronomy. First Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 29. Here's what we read. Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always, that it may be well with them and with their sons forever. Oh, that they had such a heart in them. This is God speaking. This is His desire for His own and for the children of His own. Now, when you see that text and you get a sense of what God's heart is, that He truly wants it to go well with us. He wants it to go well with our children and our grandchildren and generations after generations. But he also tells us that it takes a heart change. Oh, that they would have a heart for that. So when you read that text, you get a sense of God's attitude and deportment and concern for his own. But you also understand we can't do that. That's not a parenting text. You can't change a child's heart. Only God can change a child's heart. But that's not all God said. In just a couple verses later, he looks at us, husbands and wives and parents and grandparents, and he says, I call on you to cooperate, come alongside this, which is my expression for the generation. So verse 32 of chapter 5. So you, right, you now shall observe to do just as the Lord your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right or to the left. You shall walk in the way which the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you will possess. This is what I want, God says. Oh, that their heart would be this way. And now here's what I want you to do. There's a list of commands there. There's a list of imperatives there. And there's a promise there. You see that, right? He is offering the results of your energies and efforts consistent with his desire that our hearts would go hard after him, that our children's hearts would go after him. You can see it there. I want it to be well with you there in the middle of verse 33, and that your days may be prolonged on the earth. I captured that this way. God says that these energies and these efforts have an intention. They have a blessing and a reward attached to them. One is quality of life, and second is quantity of life. I want you to have a good life for all your days. That's quality and quantity. It's not one or the other. Oftentimes we're just given that choice. You can have quality or you can have quantity, but you can't seem to get them both. God here says, you don't have to cut anything short. I want it to be well with you, and I want your days to be prolonged. I think if you ask parents and grandparents, if I ask all of you tonight, what do you want for your children? How could you want for anything better than that? That it may be well with them, and that they would have a long life, a full life. Well, that's exactly God's desire. That is exactly God's intention. And then when he turns his attention, this attention on parents, but when he turns his attention to children, he doesn't change his perspective. You can see it in the Ten Commandments. I printed Exodus chapter 20, verse 12, and there's a commandment there for children. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. It's the same identical idea. It's the same attitude. I want this to be good for you, children. And here's your approach on this. Honor your father and your mother, because I want it to be well with you. I want your days to be prolonged. When Paul brings that into the New Testament in Ephesians chapter 6, he says it this way. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. And then he quotes, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Do you hear the repetition of this? This is God's desire. This is his intention. He wants you to listen and learn and be obedient to his commandments. And then he wants your children to do the very same thing. And his goal is not to deprive, but to bless. His goal is not to diminish your return, but to increase your return. He wants you to have quality of life and a quantity of life. That's his desire. And then in that Ephesians text for parents, he says in verse 4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. So, this is what I want you to do for generations. This is what I want children to do. And now bringing back in the immediate generation, parents, this is what I want you to do. All of this is working together. And just so you know, we haven't run from our text. If you've been here, you know our primary text is Proverbs 22. It's the same thing there. Train up a child in the way he should go. So, coming alongside God's intention are these clear imperatives, commands given to parents and to generational offspring. And it's really clear. Train them. Discipline them. Instruct them. Bring them up that way, the Apostle Paul says. Train them that way. And in Proverbs, our anchor text says, by just making the obvious point, however you train them, that is the strongest effect in how they turn out. However you train them, you'll see many years later in their adulthood. They won't stray far from the path you put them on in your training and in your instruction. That's just a axiom. It's just a observation, right? You get out of it what you put into it. All of that's wrapped into that. It's not itself a promise. It's not a gilded in gold certainty. It's just saying, put something into this and expect that when they're old, you'll get something out of this. So all of this talk of training and instruction, and we know that it's true. Examples abound for what happens when there isn't any, and examples abound for what happens when there is that environment. What environment are we talking about? Training, instruction, discipline, all of that sort of thing. And tonight, we're trying to point that to infants. When do we get started on all this training thing? Well, I mentioned to Noah last week, he was here and his baby only a few days old. I told him he was already behind. Let me quote a widely quoted pediatrician, a well-respected pediatrician in Nashville, Tennessee, Dr. William Slonecker. Here is what he says. If discipline begins on the second day of life, you're one day late. Now, how in the world can that be true? How do we put this idea of discipline and training into the first day of life? What does that mean? How can you apply? He uses the word discipline. How can you apply discipline, instruction and training? Don't think always negatively. It's a disciple, right? That's the idea of discipline. It's learning. How do you do that even from the first day? Well, we're going to try tonight to see if we can see that. And in so doing, we'll fix some points on our compass, which we're targeting. We're going to put some goals out there. And it's pretty obvious. So if you're not already in Ephesians chapter 6, go to Ephesians chapter 6. And I want to maybe overwhelm you with the simplicity of this and then challenge you with how difficult it is. So here's what Paul says, again, in Ephesians chapter 6. And verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. I just want you to pull out the two primary directives there for children. There's only two. Honor and obey. All the other words are there to help you to understand what he's saying, but that's all he's really saying. Children need to be taught to obey. That's their goal. Children need to be taught honor or respect. Paul takes all of the instruction concerning children and parenting. Notice the parents are right in the middle of it. And he distills it down to two goals because we're pretty simple thinking creatures. Two goals for every child. Obey and respect. Be obedient and extend honor. Just two very, very simple things. Now watch, he does the same thing for the parents. He says, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Two things, discipline and instruction. Very simple. Parents, you must discipline your child. And you must instruct them, you must teach them. Your discipline is for instruction and your instruction is for discipline. But you must do those two things, discipline and instruct your children to be what? Two things, obedient and respectful. That's it. We say, well, it's got to be more complicated than that. Well, it can be complicated along the way, but that's the goal. Distilled down, as only God can do it, inspiring Paul, always amazing us in the economy of words that he uses to make a point, right? God is that way. So there's two goals for every child, obedience and respect. There's two goals or tools, I should say, for every parent, two approaches to that, discipline and instruction. Now, you know, without me saying, as simple as those two things are, well, maybe I should say those four things are, two for each, but as simple as those four things are, it isn't easy. So don't confuse simple with easy. It is simple, but it is not easy. Well, why isn't it easy? If it's just that simple, why isn't it also easy? Well, we've talked about that a couple of weeks ago. It's not easy for one reason, because they're broken. Your child is broken, and so it's not easy to discipline and instruct them to be obedient and respectful. So that's what we said a couple of weeks ago. But really, there's more involved than that. And you're still in Ephesians. Look up to chapter 5. Paul has instructions for wives. And of course, that would include mothers who are wives. Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church. And 1 Corinthians 11, God is the head of Christ. So you could add that into that. He himself is the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Now, that's really not confusing. We try to make it confusing, but it isn't. It's really also quite simple. It's straightforward, and it happens to be true. What is it? What's the it? Order. That's the it. Order. Order is really pretty simple. You can see it anywhere you look. And Paul here, along with 1 Corinthians, says you can look all the way up to God and see God is the head of Christ, and Christ is the head of man, and man is the head of woman. You can see that. Christ is the head of the church. You can see it wherever you look. Certainly you can see it in the spiritual realm. You can see it in the religious realm as God has appointed it. It's really straightforward. It's very, very simple. Don't confuse it. It's really simple. But it is not what? It's not easy. Just because it is simple does not mean it is easy. It's not easy because, well, wives are broken. It's not easy because wives are broken. They were broken children and they grow up to be broken women. Despite the work of Christ in our spirit, our emotional souls remain estranged and needing to be constrained. And our bodies, of course, are just a fleshly mess. So even though it's simple, it is not easy. It is extremely hard for a wife to work in accord with God's instruction here. And then Paul, of course, turns to husbands. Husbands, love your wives the way Christ loves and loved the church and gave himself up for her. That's very, very simple. Men are to love their wives. They're to love their wives in an incredibly sacrificial way, the way Jesus incredibly sacrificed for his church. Are you following me? Very simple. Don't make that difficult. Just read your Bible and it says what it says. Husbands, you're to love your wives. But just because it's simple doesn't mean it's easy. It's not easy. It's not easy because you're broken. Husbands are broken just like wives are broken, just like children are broken. These commandments are simple, but they are not easy because of the material that we have to work with. And it makes it sometimes incredibly hard, so hard that we want to make it not as simple as it sounds. And in fact, we just want to change what it says. We want to find all the exceptions to the love rule, all the exceptions to the submission rule, all the exceptions to the obedience, and all the exceptions to respect. We want to find all the exceptions. Why? Because it's so hard. But the Bible's simple. The instructions are simple. And so it was for children. It's simple. Obey and respect. It's the right thing to do. It promises a reward. The reward doesn't complicate it. The reward motivates it. It's a good thing. We'll come back to this in a couple of weeks. It's a good thing to motivate your children with rewards. That's a great form of discipline. But like the wife submitting and the husband loving, so it is with the children's obedience and respect. It's very, very simple, but it's extremely hard. It's extremely hard. And then he takes it into the marketplace just to round it all out. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh with fear and trembling, which means masters who aren't always kind to you. There's a fear and trembling in it. But you still have to be sincere. You have to be obedient as if you're being obedient to Christ. You got to take the manager out of it. We work as unto the Lord. That's what the Bible would teach us. It's really pretty simple. And then masters, you're supposed to do the same things to them. You shouldn't be threatening. You know that their master and yours is in heaven. There's no partiality with God. You're not special. It's pretty simple. The marketplace is simple. There's a boss and there is an employee, and the boss is to command and the employee is to obey. The boss should do it with kindness and with a view toward God, and the employee should serve the same way. Simple. How many of you had a hard week at work this week? Well, it's not because it's complicated. It's simple. But it becomes hard. It becomes hard and sometimes incredibly hard because every person in view in all of these examples has the same problem. Every one of them is broken. They have a heart that's disinclined toward God. It's the curse inside of us. It's that evil that lives in me, Paul says, even as I have been changed. I find this evil present in me. And it's hard. It's the fall. And so your child has that problem when it comes to our goal, obedience and respect. Well, I've got this curse within me. Your child would say, could they understand it or say it? And of course, the infant can't say it. But that's the reality of it. That's the truth of it. And you can see it, listen, from the very first day. You can see that from the very first day. So I didn't see that. I mean, my baby was so cute and so cuddly. That's what I saw on the first day. Well, look closer. You don't have to look too far back. Some of you got young kids. Noah's just a couple weeks out. Look closer at that cute and cuddly baby from day one. They are so demanding. They are so self-centered. It's as if there's no one else in the world except them. They are only tuned to their needs. They have absolutely no sense of anybody else's needs. They aren't thinking about anything around them. They're only thinking about themselves from the very first day. And it's obvious. They're not in touch with their surroundings. They can't. The senses aren't fully developed yet, but they are certainly in touch with themselves from day one. So they cry. And then maybe they scream. And when they cry and scream, they have given absolutely no concern to the people around them. None. I mean, they didn't even pause for a moment to think about their mother and the suffering she just endured. An incredible suffering that Jesus equates with like the end of the world kind of suffering. Birth pain suffering. But the baby gives no thought to that. He just screams and cries. No empathy for the father who's trying to take care of the mother, though awkward and uncertain in that. Trying to keep his job, trying to keep ends together. That's kind of got a time stamp on it because these days you get parental leave even if you're a dad. Back in the day, you didn't get that. You had to hold your job, right? Try to care for your wife. Do all that at once. The baby's not giving any thought to that. Baby doesn't care. The baby just cries. Just continues to insist on their selfish, self-centered, self-interested self. That's from day one. It's true for every baby. There's no exceptions. They are preoccupied with themselves. Is that a good way to capture that? A newborn baby, from the moment they are born, are entirely preoccupied with themselves. They act as if nobody exists on this entire planet except them. So how do you respond to that? Oh, now this is where the instruction comes in for parenting. How do you respond to that? Don't argue with me, because it's true. Very, very early, they have expressed their preoccupation with themselves. How will you now respond, very, very early, to that statement of self-centeredness that was just born to you? When Dr. Slonecker spoke about it being too late if you wait for day two, I can tell you, he wasn't talking about spanking your day-old baby. When he said discipline is a day late if you wait till the second day, he wasn't talking about spanking or yelling or even saying no. So what was he talking about? Well, let's let him talk about it. Mom and Dad, from day one, remember, you are in charge. Love your child enough to establish control. Even as you work to meet the needs of your child, don't confuse those needs with your child's demands. Don't let yourself think that way, Dad and Mom, not even for a moment. That baby is completely dependent on you. That means they are dependent on your well-being, on your confidence, and on your ability to meet those needs. So parents, this is a way of thinking. More than it is a way of doing, it is a way of thinking. I'm in control. Yes, I just received a human being completely preoccupied with themselves, but they're not the only person in the room. They don't know that. You know that. And Dr. Slonecker says, don't forget that. You're in control. They're not in control. From day one. Another quote, all too often I see mothers who are afraid to lead their infants. I get this call, my 6-month-old baby is crying and he seems hot. Well, does your child have a fever, I ask? I don't know, he won't let me take his temperature. So Dr. Slonecker asks, who's in control? Who's in control? If you cannot control your 6-month-old, how will you control your 6-year-old? How will you control your 12-year-old? You are the parent in the room. You are the responsible party. And you have to think like that. And I'm not, again, so focused on how you act. There's lots of different ways to apply this truth. But I'm telling you how you have to think. That baby is not in charge. When they become 12 years old and you don't have control and you so desperately wish you could fix it, well, you were here tonight and you heard someone say, you should have started sooner. You failed early on. Grace is great, but we got to tell the truth about it. You failed early on, and here's how you failed. You gave up control. You surrendered your responsibility to a baby. To a baby. Now, I don't want to dwell on that too much, but it's certainly food for thought. But just some simple points to make the point. Number one, the goal from day one is obedience and respect. Now, you'll spend years on that and some really pointed times on that. I'm not talking about pointing your time to that, but I'm saying that was the goal from day one. It's not a goal that arrives later. It's a goal that arrived with the child. Don't forget that. Number two, the beginning days are days of positioning. Again, I repeat, it's less about what you do in those very early days and months and more about what you know and what you think. What is the mom's position in the home and as it regards to that child? That's what you're establishing. It's what you're getting centered in your mind in these first days when that totally self-consumed human being arrived on the scene. In your mind, even as you act, sometimes out of ignorance, sometimes out of training this way and training that way in this culture and that society, but as you act, don't ever let that direct how you think. What is mom's position? What is dad's position? This is position time. Take your positions. A child has arrived, right? Take your positions. What is mom's position? What is dad's position? They are the parents. They were the recipients of this gift. That's their position. Now, they can be good parents or bad parents. It doesn't change their position. They can be good moms or dad moms, bad moms. That doesn't change their position. They were put in this position. Who put you in that position? God did. God did. When He gave you that gift, you are the responsible party in the room. Always. You are the authority in the room. Always. That's your position. Maybe this is helpful. What's the child's position? These are positioning days and months, the earliest of days and months in the life of your child. You must take your position. What's the child's position? Well, they're this great gift, worthy of great care. Absolutely. That's their position. But remember, they're not the responsible party. They're not. They are not the authority. They're not. And like, as much as they'd like to believe it true, if they could think reasonably enough to believe it true, they certainly express that they think it's true. The world does not revolve around them. The world doesn't revolve around them. They are not the center of the universe. They are not even the center of the home universe. Now, those senses that your infant is still forming, I got to hold Noah's baby the other day, and he was looking at me, I think, but I had to ask, can he see me? I don't know. Is there a doctor in the house? Can the baby see me? Well, probably not clearly yet. His eyes don't seem to fix on anything yet. But the senses are forming, right, if they're not fully formed. The same with their ears. They can hear and they can see, but watch, they are not able to distinguish in any way what is good for them and what is not. They can't. But here's what I know. They are aware. They are aware of their needs, at least as far as they see them. And again, not able to determine for themselves what is right or wrong. They at least have a sense of a need. Again, that's what leads to the cries, right? But is the cry crying for what's good for them or for what's bad for them? Well, that's up to somebody else. It's not up to the baby. It's up to the parents. They're not just aware of their needs. Oh, you'll find out right away if you haven't already, and most of you have already found out, but we're kind of all pointing at Noah like, you're about to find out. Watch. They are aware of your response to their needs. They're aware of that. They figure it out amazingly fast. You see, they have the needs as they see them. They don't know whether they're good or bad, but they're aware of them. And then they are aware of how you respond to what they are aware of. And they are aware of what gets your response. They're aware of that right away. They cry and you respond and they're aware of that. Now, you have to determine what the need is. And that's hard, isn't it? Is there any mom here that's raised a child yet that you're just not certain, right? You're just not certain. Is it their stomach? Is it their head? Is it their fever? Are they just mad? Or are they just crazy? You don't know. Well, they don't know. And there's a measure that we plead God's mercy and all of that, right? But I just want you to understand, in these earliest of days and earliest of months, between your ears, you can never forget that you're the responsible party, not them. And that you're responsible for how you respond to them, not them. Your doctor can help you. Your mother can help you. Others with experience with babies can help you, right? Let them help you. You need the help. The signals that your baby sends, that's a help as far as they go. But the signals you send, listen. The baby sends mixed signals. The signals you send can't be mixed signals. Do the work. Learn. But even all the mistakes that you will surely make and we have all made, don't ever forget what your position is, what your role is, what the goal is, and understand that they are aware of all of that in ways we can't yet even still understand in all of our study of humanity. Will there be fear there? Yes. So you pray, God grant me peace. Because I don't want to mess this up. This is such a precious gift. Uncertainty? Always. God, grant me wisdom. Grant me wisdom. Failure? Count on it. God, grant me grace. Grant me grace. So those are the earliest of days, the earliest of months. Discipline is already beginning. And it's starting with you and your position and your attitude. Don't surrender that. I've counseled parents who, by their confession, not mine, would say, I lost it early. Second month, I had no control. I didn't have any insight, I didn't have any wisdom, I didn't even seek any. I was just managing the mess. And now I can't manage it anymore. Well, let me add some more instruction pointed first for moms. Some pointers for mom. In these earliest days, weeks and months, reserve some time for yourself. Why would you say that? Well, a couple of obvious reasons. Number one, rest is essential in those early days. In ways I can't relate, but any mother here could gladly tell you. People step in to help. That's wonderful. But the world moves on. And help is gone. And you have to reserve some time for yourself. You have to rest. Because right away, all these things rush in. You realize right away that being a mom was, well, maybe nobody told you. It means part-time doctor, part-time nurse, part-time psychologist, part-time teacher, part-time preacher. If you have more than one kid, part-time referee, part-time cook. If it goes really bad, part-time policeman. And for a lot of mothers, working full-time. All of that and working full-time. Make time for yourself. A failure to make this a priority, listen to me carefully, a failure to make this a priority is leverage for the child to usurp your authority and convince you that it was always, always about them. Ladies, you got to know that. Moms, you need to know that. Don't let the child use your exhaustion as leverage to convince them that they're in charge. And that means, listen, dads, that means you need to be engaged, and more on that in a minute. You need to be sensitive to the needs of the woman you're living with. As the Bible would say, you need to live with your wife and this new mother in an understanding way. And that doesn't mean, I understand. No, it means find out. Understand. Where do you hold her up? Where do you help? Remember, her strength is your strength. Her joy is your joy. And that's true, baby or not. And again, a little bit on that in a minute. All right, so moms, you need to reserve some time for yourself. You have to do it. Your baby needs it. Second, don't fight the things you can't change. Another way of saying that is you need to learn to live and accept the inevitable. So what are you talking about? Well, let me say, first of all, unmet expectations are the root of most of the critical issues that I counsel as a pastor. Unmet expectations. And now as a mother with this huge responsibility, you need to not overestimate what you expect the reality to be. Some things are inevitable. And if you don't get this sorted out, here's what you'll learn, moms. Everything in your life can be pretty good. In fact, you can have good health. The baby can have good health. Your husband can be devoted and doing all that he knows to do, at least, to try to help. There's plenty of food in the house. There's a warm place to sleep. There's a dependable car. The list goes on. But if just one thing doesn't suit you or meet your expectations, you know that'll wreck everything else. It just wrecks everything else. That's a part of our humanity. Man, we could fixate on what we didn't get and completely forget everything else that we have. Dr. James Dobson writes this. This is called discontent. And I wonder today, James writes in his most recent rewriting, I wonder how many women are suffering from discontent in areas that 15 or 20 years ago, listen, wasn't even a thing to be considered. Because it wasn't even a thing. What's he talking about? Facebook and Twitter and telephones and all those unmet expectations that they produce in the spirit of a woman. You're prone to discontent. All of us are. You have to learn to be content. Philippians chapter 4, verse 11 and 12, Paul says, I don't speak from want because I've learned to be content in whatever circumstance I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, of having abundance and suffering need, and the secret is to be content. Now, don't miss the beginning of that text. The Apostle Paul, perhaps the greatest Christian to have lived in the New Testament church's history, had to learn it. Which means what? It wasn't natural. It's not natural. So I just tell you, moms, don't let the world establish for you expectations that you could never meet. Don't let the world do that to you. And that way you need to find some away space from all of that. Because it's out there everywhere. What should you look like now that you've had a baby? 6 months, really? And you don't yet look like you should look now that you've had a baby? Thirdly, don't ignore the things you should change. Well, we're always changing. We're always learning. Nothing like a baby in the house to expose your greatest weaknesses. So just some practical things here I would just say, if you don't already, make a list. And prioritize your list every day. That way, at the end of the day, when there's still things left to be done on your list, you can say, well, I did get the most important things on my list done. That's just common sense. That's just good counsel. Lastly, for the ladies, don't deal with big problems when you are tired. Whatever causes it, your discontent or your husband's failure to be who he should have been, or just life. Don't deal with big problems when you're tired. I almost said don't deal with big problems at the end of the night, but you might be tired first thing in the morning as a mom. That is not the time to take it on. It just isn't. Move along. Deal with it when you have the energy to deal with it. When you're alert, when you're awake. And all of that tells me to see point one again. Get some rest. Because you got big things you got to deal with. And you cannot do it on an empty tank. I hope that's not too practical. But I think it's important. So now let me give some pointers for Dad. What is true historically and biblically, which we'll dwell much more on later, is that the mother is the primary caregiver for a child. But that does not mean, Dad, that your role has somehow now been diminished by that. So I want you to remember, Dads, what the Bible says to you. Number one, the sacrifice falls to you. Ephesians 5:25, we looked at it earlier. Husbands, here's your charge. Love your wives. Love that mother. Love them the way Christ loved the church. And that is always sacrificial. He gave himself up for the church. That's how you love. So here's the question, Dads. Some in reflection and some in the moment. What have you given up for that child? What have you sacrificed for that child's mother, your wife? What has the birth of the child cost you? If you can't name a sacrifice, and I'm talking about one, I don't know how else to say it, one you can feel, one that you can in some sense measure, a sacrifice that this child in your home has now cost you. If you can't feel that in some way, then you're not doing your job. Because love sacrifices. And there's never more important time for a husband and a father to do his job than when a new baby's in the house. And let me just state the obvious, because sometimes it's not obvious. In this picture of Ephesians 5 that God inspired Paul to give in just really simple, pointed, but very difficult things, he does not call the wife to sacrifice. He calls the husband to sacrifice. So what is the button your wife wears in the home with this new baby on the scene? Most homes, it looks like sacrifice. Well, what button are you wearing, Dad? Well, I'm just going along to get along. You're wearing the wrong button. Love demands sacrifice. What sacrifice is clearly in view now that the baby's come home? Secondly, the authority is yours. Yes, you are the head. And with it, all the responsibility. You will give an account one day for how you loved your wife and trained your child. We looked at Ephesians 6:4 already. Fathers, don't provoke your children to anger. Fathers, bring them up in discipline and instruction. Clearly, that's a text that would see parenting involved. But God says, fathers. Fathers. So while your wife may serve that primary role of the early months of training, God doesn't see it that way. If you want another comparison, while Eve surely did take that fruit and eat it, God didn't see it that way. That was Adam's fall. Well, it's the same thing. You got a new baby in the house. You're called to love and to love with sacrifice. And that means that the primary caregiver needs your love more than ever, more than ever. You can't be a no-show. Because God will hold you responsible for that. That's not my opinion, by the way. That's God's opinion. Dads, I've been there. I know. We fail here. We'll find all kinds of imaginative ways to not give up anything now that there's a baby in the house. We'll just work it into another little corner of our calendar or work it up to the attic or create things called man caves, all of which might have a good and right purpose. But this is not the time for you to take the time. It's not the time. Your wife needs you. Your wife needs you. All right, some pointers for both of you. That's not my first one. I may not have my first one here. There it is. Make time for each other. I already told you, Mom, you need to take time for yourself. I was taught this many years ago by my pastor, Dr. Ed Young, at Second Baptist Church in Houston. And when I say I was taught it, I don't mean he mentioned it once. He drilled it into us in the years that I was there. He talked a lot about the family and talked a lot about the home and talked a lot about a husband and a wife. And here's what he said to parents. The most important thing you will ever do for your child is to show them that you love each other. Nothing else compares, Dr. Young would say. And he would back it up biblically, and he convinced me, and we'll talk some more about it in the weeks ahead. Don't let the child become the center of your home. Your marriage is the center of your home. Don't let the child become the center of your home. Your marriage is the center of your home. And you have to take time for each other. Remember, when God gave you that gift, He gave you that gift. Maybe I'm saying remember, you may not have learned this yet, but He gave you that gift so that one day you would give it away if it's a daughter, and kick him out if it's a son. You raise them to leave. That's what the Bible says. God created a man and a woman so that they might leave their families and cleave to one another. If you make your child the center of your home, certainly even in the earliest weeks and months, you'll be fighting for your marriage one day. I've counseled too many couples who, when the kids were gone, couldn't find any reason to stay together. The kids were gone. When did they make that mistake? First few weeks. First few months. When those children were given to them. Cherish that gift. Love that gift. But never forget. They are not the center of your home. Your marriage is. That's the most important thing you can show your children. Well, there's an awful lot of stuff that fights for first place, but that's for tonight. They leave, you stay. Let them know that right away. I mean, I don't mean like right away, but right away. Okay, I put the second one up there already for both of you. Depend on God. Depend on God. This task is too daunting, too scary to try to do this by yourself. And when I say by yourself, I mean the two of you. You need to pray. You need to meditate on God's truth. You need to seek His face and remember the hope that He gives you when He gives you that child. And know this most of all, that God in His infinite wisdom and perfect understanding, who knows the first from the last and everything in between, looked across time and determined to give that child to you. To you. God did that. Don't ever forget that. And depend on Him. Depend on Him. Another one. Benefit from the body. Raising a child demands a community. I know that was a liberal talking point that we certainly resisted for good reasons, but it's still true at this point. Those children need to be raised in a community. And I'm talking about, as Christians, a community of faith. A community that shares faith, shares and understands God's goals for children. One that will share the load. Right? So you can spend some time together. You need that community. We need it more than ever today when Christians have decided they don't need that community. You need a community that will rejoice with you when you rejoice and that will weep with you when you weep. So that's my instruction for tonight. For the earliest days, the earliest months. And maybe just that truth to leave us with. You belong in the family of God, and most of you belong to this family. And together, let's commit to rejoice with those who rejoice in the gift of children, and weep with those who weep, and together help them carry that load. Amen? All right. Thanks for being here. You're dismissed.